Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm Niles McFlower. And tonight, hopefully another great show dealing with the virtues, revelations of God. Now, I've done shows similar to this subject, but not, again, the way I'm going to present it tonight. And I'm going to tie together some things that didn't get covered in the past. I think that this is an interesting show from the standpoint that many people say, well, can you give me some ideas of how I can tell other people that God exists? Because a lot of people say, well, anything you say, you know, there's some scientific answer, or chaos theory, or this or that. And the point of tonight's show is that we can sense God when there is the creation of virtuous action. And our senses tell us that directly, not that we have to deliberate or be taught it. As a matter of fact, there's ample evidence of numerous people having experience of a virtuous circumstance, either created by them or that they're part of, where God becomes revealed to them. And it is through that one can see God. Now, there are some other alternatives. I mean, certainly some people claim if one can see evil, maybe you could see God, because if evil exists, then would that not behold that there is a God? But other people have an argument against that, and that is that if evil exists, that means there couldn't be a God, because why would God permit such a thing to be? The quick answer for that is, if there's going to be freedom to have creation on the part of people and other living things, that freedom comes at the cost of non-interference by God in circumstances where evil is doing what it does, which is to obscure itself and to hide and to get other people to believe God doesn't exist. So in many respects, the answer may seem circular, but it's that there needs to be freedom, and freedom has a cost, and the cost is that we human beings in other life needs to deal with evil in ways that we'll talk about a bit tonight, but mostly in ways that I've covered in prior shows. So that isn't really what the emphasis of tonight is going to be about. Today it's about the more, I'll call it, the positive side, which is that virtue in itself reveals God in a number of ways. We're going to go through some of the science of it and some of the experiential parts of it, and we're going to talk about virtues as they apply dimensionally, because the big issue for humans to gain understanding about is that there's much more to the universe than the dimension that we presently are living in. And where our consciousness is focused, which right now, when you're alive in a particular place, is where it's focused, tends to, we'll say, slant or bias our senses to believe, mostly falsely, that this is all there is. Now, of course, when we go on to move and live in the astral dimension, or which is a bunch of sub-dimensions, and especially when we go on to live in the monastic or mental dimensions, the it's less of an obscurity that there are other dimensions of time and space, and because we still remember, for the most part, our lives before, or life before, depending upon where we're talking about. And that, of course, makes it clear to us that, I was alive there, now I'm alive here, so there's other places to be alive at. and that changes our perspective. But for people who are living here in the physical world, illusion is at its greatest, partly because we don't directly sense those other dimensions, for the most part, and partly because the virtues, which we're going to talk about tonight, that are created in those other worlds, do not have the same impact on our senses as they do in this world. And so let's start with this world so we can work our way into other places. And in this world, the virtues that I'm going to describe have to do with cooperation and sharing. Okay, so that's the primary emphasis of virtue. And in each case, in the worlds of what is known as energy-modeled dimensions, in each case where energy is a primary part of reality, the virtue that is associated with that realm has an effect on activity. Okay, so we could say that those virtues are called the action or activity virtues, and they dominate our senses more than the non-energy virtues, because those virtues we can't sense through energy, but only through spirit. And that's a little more difficult for us. But those other dimensions are just the highest two, called the monadic, which is like the second one major dimension in the universe. And then the first or highest dimension, the logoic, some people refer to it, or other names for it. But the thing is about the highest dimension, it again is a spiritual only place. There is no energy that is manifested there, and you can't talk about activity, because activity requires interaction, requires energy by our own bias in it, in our definitions, in the realms where human beings live. We could talk about it. We could, if we were beings that weren't so fixed by our senses to be energy bound. Then we could talk about dimensions of spirit, and we could reflect on and even contemplate the virtues of those dimensions more clearly and more understandably. But for human beings, it's a difficult thing, because we just have a lot of trouble with that, and it's a bit far off for a human to talk about their monadic sense of things, or I don't know, their logoic sense of things, you know. It's just too removed from most humans' experiences, but not all. If you're a very advanced human, it actually may make some sense. You may actually sense something from that. Okay, so let's start with where we are. Where we are is in a dimension where forces are the dominant element in terms of the exchanges of energy, not virtue. So, in this world, at this time, and based upon where we are in this world, being the physical part of it, there's an electromagnetic part of the physical called the etheric, but it's still the physical. And within this particular realm, there is much more sense of force and the forces that inhibit our ability to accurately sense and therefore to intelligently interact with our world and each other. Then there is the ability to sense God, spirit, and virtue being, again, the energy side of God's spiritual beings. So virtues always have to do with what we call form or energy. Those are almost interchangeable words. And so virtue is God's thought or spirit when it's in form. And it's a dominant issue to us, but it is not as dominant by any stretch where we exist now in this world than is force. So it is difficult for us, within all of the forces, which also can be defined as illusion, that we have coming from our senses, The senses, when they are working within a very forceful, we'll call it field, have a slanting or a misunderstanding and a lack of awareness of accuracy and correctness. The forces themselves, in one way of speaking about it, do damage to our senses and reduce our senses. So we don't sense as well, and we don't sense as much, because the forces are so strong. Now, that's here and now. That doesn't mean some other planet that's in physical existence, because some planets have removed most of the forces in their world. Now, who did that? That was human beings, in cooperation sometimes with higher kingdoms, but mostly human beings, reached a point where they reached a position of sacredness within their own sense, so that most people, probably a plurality, if not the majority of people in that particular world, are no longer in a situation in which forces cause most of the sense that a person experiences. So force is removed. When it's removed, the senses start acting better. They start functioning more and much more accurately. And the amount of intelligence in each interaction goes way up. In the world that we are in right now, the amount of intelligence is low. How low? Well, some people like to use the gauge of consciousness to determine how much senses lead to the ability to understand. And in this world, it's somewhere in the 2% range on an average. That's out of 100%. So you're looking at 98% inaccuracy because of forces, with an average of maybe 2% accuracy. And that may be even a liberal number. It may not even be that high. But it is nonetheless a close enough one so our perspective for this evening can be garnered about what I'm referring to when I say there's a lack of intelligent activity, and therefore a lack of perceived virtue, and virtues are the primary revelations of God. So the amount that most people experience God directly in terms of their consciousness, now not just awareness, but it's both in a sense, it is about 2%. Now, for a lot of people, that may be a shock, because some people say, well, I know God exists. It's revealed to me. I can sense it. And why? I know a whole bunch of people who I go to church with them, and they, you know, pray to God and all this stuff. Well, the faith in God and belief in God is a good thing. But it is not the revelation of God, because the revelation of God means that one is aware of God's purpose in the creation of life and for further other very big concepts. And that's what I'm referring to. I know that's a big, high, you know, bar to try to achieve. But if we're going to be realistic about this, faith does not achieve the goals of what the virtues are here for. And I will discuss more of that as we move on. It just isn't sufficient. There was a time when it did better than it does today. Let's talk about that. Let's say we go back 1,000 years in Western civilization. 1,000 years ago, faith had a bit more ability with the what was then the dominant race, was the fourth sub-race of all of humanity, or the fifth race of humanity. Almost everybody on the planet was a member of the fifth race, but the majority, the vast majority of people were members of the fourth sub-race. And the odd thing about the fourth sub-race is that although it was less developed in terms of monastic abilities, that meaning it wasn't as mentally acute in its deductions of things and logic, etc. Now, I'm talking about the people on an average. I'm talking about the great scholars of 1,000 or 1,100 AD. I'm talking about the average. But most people had limited ability to sense God using their mental senses very completely. So they didn't. They used and relied upon much more of their astral senses. That's okay, because that's where they were more focused, even though they're the fifth race and more mental than any of the Atlantean fourth races. They still had, we'll call it, this sub-ray aspect, which was both more feminine, directed more towards the astral world in a sense, but also they were not at the point where we would call them grand scholars, or the majority of people being even reasonably educated. So their reliance on the faith issue and trying to reveal God to them is more acceptable based upon their overall ability. And since virtue is always measured by one's ability to create more with and about and for God, then that really kind of fits in with this whole scenario of folks from 1,000 years ago and before, of course, having a more faith-based understanding. And that was acceptable up to the point where the majority of people entered into the fifth sub-race about 500 years later than about 500 years ago. And that then kind of tipped the balance. Now, the rationale here has to do with forces. If you're not capable of sensing something, the amount of forces that actually mess with you, so to speak, and your ability to be aware through your senses, is far less than if you are capable of doing it and you choose not to. So that's how this whole system of capability comes into play when we're dealing with the issue of getting revelation through virtues and in comparison to faith alone. Therefore, if you can't create as much virtue as someone else, you're not penalized by additional force in your life. Oddly, your life will become less forceful, even less karmically forceful. It's hard to understand if it's true. You're less responsible for your lack of, because of your lack of response. The statement, ignorance is bliss, has some reality to it. I'm not going to promote that as a way of life. I'm just saying that there is more than just a grain of truth, that if a person is not yet capable of sensing, they are not forcibly dealt a hand that they can't deal with, therefore, because of the fact that they literally don't have the ability to reach a level of awareness at some higher point, and they don't experience as many forces in their life. And if you look around and you follow what I'm saying, and you examine the folks that truly are less able, you'll see their lives are not more forceful, but less forceful than those who are very able or capable and choose not to. That becomes a much more serious force getter. How come? Because that's the way energy responds. If you have a strong mind, energy follows thought greater than its own, and that mind tells you the wrong things, and you choose to believe in the wrong things, and you choose to exercise in the wrong things, the results can be much more forceful than if you don't think much about anything, and you have faith backing you up about the things that you don't have much awareness or understanding about. You're karmically and in the immediate sense of force, you're going to have less than the folks who say, well, I'll just be selfish because it's better. I feel better when I'm selfish, and I'll just ignore this business about what this guy's talking about on the radio about virtues. Forget that. But you know, they have the awareness, and they're not using it in that way. So then you end up with the greater forces. What do the forces do? Well, the forces diminish sense. So eventually, if a person really is selfish enough, their sense is so diminished that they really aren't capable at a certain point. So there is a kind of safety net. It's a weird one. That as we exercise our selfishness, which many of us do most of the time, it could be 98% of the time, our senses diminish rapidly. That means not only do we become less aware, but our bodies age more fat more quickly, and our life expectancy is shortened in this realm, all from the forces that are going against our centers and that cause what is known as a stuck life energy or chi energy, which leads to illness and diminution of sense and eventually pain and suffering. Wow. And aging. So when we put this together in a way that I'm using a very strong energy model tonight to explain all this, because I haven't done that before, not to this level. And I think that a lot of people have in the past thought that virtues are some kind of almost poetic expression of statement, not without any science involved, without any cause and effect relationships to anything that you can tangibly measure. But that's not true. We can tangibly measure the amount of forces each person is experiencing by all the models that I just suggested. So if a person is aging faster, if their senses are diminishing, if they're making more what we call mistakes, which is really separating more time from space, which causes them to take longer to do anything, and whatever they do is more subject to inaccuracy, even to disastrous inaccuracies or grand mistakes, those are the consequences, and those are all measurable. Every one of those things are measurable. So science is a real, in order to have science, you got to have, because it's based on truth, it comes from mathematics and measurement. So if you don't have that, you really don't have science. But I'm saying this is scientifically measurable. And if we can measure virtues and or the lack of virtues through science, which I'm saying is possible, then we've got ourselves a real bona fide way of showing the revelation of God. And that's what tonight's show is about. So you can see this is a whole different way of going at this. I know I've used the poetic method in the past and faith, and I've used a bit of this science, but not enough to probably convince enough people and or to teach enough people how they can discuss this with others who have different opinions. And you can actually, if you get it good enough, and maybe listen to the show a few times, and read some of the stuff I've written, you can put it all together, and I think you could come up with a really good argument, even against some very, well, say, persistent thinkers who believe God doesn't exist. So it can be helpful, because you can maybe change some people's minds. And if you can't change their minds, you can maybe get them to think about it and test out the theories. You know, testing is good. You don't have to change anyone's mind if they are willing to test it. Because if it's true, it will come out when they test it, provided their test is a valid test. Some people test things by setting up straw man. They call it arguments and fake things. But then there's no hope in it. Those people who do that aren't going to listen to you, and they aren't going to be fair in the way they test anything. So they're just biased to the point where there's not much you can change about them. All right, so looking at this whole idea of cooperation and sharing. What does that mean? Because let's try to label that in some scientific way. Well, when you cooperate with somebody, it doesn't mean that you have the same sense as they do about the, we'll call it the nitty-gritty of the operations that each of you are in. Cooperation is something different. It's not each person having the same perception. It's that each person shares their perception with somebody else and or others, and in the sharing of the perceptions, their awareness, of the world, they give a relative scale so the everybody can experience what other people are experiencing. And the sharing of sense leads to reduction in force. That's the basis of cooperation. I know a lot of people say, oh, well, isn't it exchanging goods and services? It could be, but that's not what it is. What it is that each person says, well, here's my sense, and let's hear your sense, and let's get up 100 other people's sense, and figure out what is the closest average, or putting it all together, that gets us to the closest amount of the least amount of force. The least amount of force means that less time and energy is used to achieve any particular event, and there is much more intelligence in everyone's activity, so time is obviously saved, but there is a resultant in less force, so the senses improve or at least don't diminish as quickly. And therefore, the bodies don't diminish as quickly, and the whole thing improves. That's cooperation. Well, that's a kind of interesting way of defining it, but it is a more scientific way. Again, different than may have been the way you've used the word or thought about it in the past, simply because it's present, more connotative, and even denotative, depending upon your sources, ways of explaining it, has more to do with operative issues. This is more conceptual. The reason concepts are better than operational is operations change all the time. And they can fool us because there can be behind the operational factors many different causes of why the operation is or is not working properly. When you understand the concept, it's a lot better because you can deduce the likely correct results without having to just base it on some examples which may be contaminated by all kinds of other variables that you're not even aware of. Maybe you may be aware of, but you're not using. All right, so when this goes on, when you have cooperation, people by nature become more virtuous in the physical world. And you might say, well, you said you were first talking about it like it's a universal thing, but now you're talking about the physical world. What about the astral world? Yeah, that's a problem if you're going to use my definition, because in the astral world, you need to cooperate much less with others to achieve the same level of lack or lessening of force. Now, there's a reason for that. Because the forces are so high in the physical world, if you don't cooperate, your senses are so battered and diminished so rapidly, it's almost, we'll say, impossible to adequately live. And you're constantly in threat of losing your life or losing a significant part of your life by not cooperating. In the astral world, not that way, you see. The astral world is mostly created by energy following the thought of individuals and not collectively the thought of whole planets or countries or something like that. Why is that? Well, because it's many, many thousands of times more efficient and better, and energy is better, in following the thought of the people and even animals and somewhat even plants, but that exists in the astral world. So you don't need as much cooperation to achieve even better results than what you can get in the physical world by cooperating. That's a strange thing. And a lot of people say, well, why would God do that? Well, there's a very good reason. The senses that you use to cooperate are totally different than the astral senses. The senses you use are the sensuous senses, or the physical senses, also known as the etheric physical senses. And when you use those senses, you have a totally different result, because those senses are tough and hardened, but they are not misery sensitive. They are almost insensitive by necessity. And it's a big problem, because this insensitivity is of little use unless it's been enlightened in the astral world. Even if you've had a physical body, for some reason you kind of schlep it along with you to the astral world, it wouldn't do you much good, because the energies in the astral world are so much finer and they have so much less force that you wouldn't even, if the physical senses can barely, they wouldn't sense them. Now, if you enlighten the physical senses, they join with the astral senses, and that's a whole different thing. Yes, then they are very helpful, but there's so few people who have done that, enlighten their physical senses. I mean, that's like you can count them on your fingers and toes. I mean, it's just too few people that have done that. That's a part of the next kingdom's apparatus, not ours. So it's not very meaningful to talk about it. There's a tiny, tiny bit that we garner in each lifetime of enlightening a small, very small fraction of less than a quarter of 1% or whatever, of our senses to our astral and our physical senses to our astral. And that does stay with us, but it isn't enough to make much of a difference. And so the reason you can't really count on your physical senses, it isn't because they're just gone. It's because if they were with you, there wouldn't be any good in it. Yeah, that's the point. Now, there's another argument about this, and that is that some of you already know this, that people in the lower astral planes, the subplanes, particularly the 6th and 7th, to be honest, it's about where it is, and the 8th for sure, use other people in the physical world, and especially the etheric part of the physical world, when they're kind of at the point of dying or certain other conditions, as puppets, so to speak, to gain sense from those folks. At tremendous cost. It tears the web that blocks the two bodies from abnormally joining before they should. It allows these monsters of vampires of sense to steal sense from people here. But their sense is still of the physical world. What they're missing and what they want isn't more physical sense in the astral world. It wouldn't do them any good. What they want is physical sense while they live in the astral world because they like the force. Talk about nutso. They actually like the feeling of force, whether it's sexual or criminal or violent or we'll call it insanely excited. They like that. That's what they live for. Or it could be extreme materiality, a sense of ownership of physical, tangible things. Whatever it is, whatever gets them going, they'll try and steal that sense. But that doesn't count, not from what I'm talking about, because they're only using the sense to actually experience something about the etheric physical world. They're not trying to steal the sense so they can use it in the astral world. It wouldn't do much good, and they don't do it that way. There's no reason to. Now, they do steal sense from people who live in the astral world, and we're going to get to that part, too, but that's different. That's different. All right, so when we move on to the astral world, as an example, cooperation and sharing do not become necessities. And another way to look at this is, let's say we all went suddenly for a visit right now to any astral subworld. We could create most of the things that we want to achieve, and we could have most of the kind of interactions that we want through our creative imagination and or through emotional aspects of living and or through love. That's it. And I talk about love, not about like universal, oh, with love everybody. I talk about love from specific people back and forth. So this is the way of life in the astral world, not like here at all. And the forces, even if you're really selfish, you live in the worst parts, like the 7th subworld, the forces are de minimis in comparison to the physical world. Well, what would that mean? That means that the senses diminish somewhat less rapidly on an average. Some people can do a real bang-up job of getting rid of them real quick, almost as fast as if they were physically alive because they're abnormally selfish. But most people, their senses last a lot longer. That means that their bodies last a lot longer. And this is an experiential time, not the kind of time where we're measuring in comparison to physical world time. This is the time that you actually live there. And therefore, the bodies last much longer. 500 years is not unusual. You know, wow, 500 years. Yeah, that's right. So you could live that long, depending upon the subworld and how selfish you are. That's way different, isn't it? It's because the forces are much reduced. And the senses just don't wear out as fast. Now, yes, they could wear out really fast if you were living in the seventh subworld, but the people who live in a sphere, which is actually much more selfish and violent and horrible than the people living in the other dimensions, those are evil. And evil folk, believe it or not, they don't age virtually at all because they steal the senses from anyone and everyone else around them. And that's what they do for a living, you might say. Kind of a strange statement. They live more by stealing and by torturing and causing others to suffer. And they use two elements. They use the element of power most of the time, and once in a while, they'll use a little bit of creation, but not much. So that's their main meat of staying alive. And they can stay alive for a long period of time. And the forces are put at bay because they transfer those forces onto others. So they age more quickly. They are destroyed, in a sense, more quickly. They are harmed more. And they love that. They think that's great. Hey, I don't let somebody else pay for it. I'll get a free ride, they think. However, in karmic terms, it all keeps all of the forces just are put at bay. Eventually, those forces have to be dealt with by that person, believe it or not. It could take a long time, thousands of years or longer, but eventually the system fails. They can't get enough sense. They stay alive. Their body reverts to its what would be its state if it had not been able to transfer all the energy to others. Sort of like a big spring comes back on. And they literally crack and cannot maintain a human body any longer, and they start living their life with whatever human level of consciousness they actually have, but in life forms of a very different kind, usually lower level insect life or something like that. Wow. And that could take thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe even a million years or longer, to come back to a point where they can sense and be a human being, where they can be conscious in sense in the same realm at the same time as humanity. Woo. Well, that usually solves the problem for those folks, although it's a long time in coming. Okay. So I hope that so far we have got kind of, you know, because we're going to take a break here in another half minute or so. We've got kind of a general structure about what I'm talking about when I'm talking about sense and awareness in a more scientific way, talking about it through energy and talking about it in ways in which it can be more clearly understood as something that is tangible, it can be measured, you can mathematically compute it. And that means if virtues are revelations of God, now really you haven't got to that part yet, but if they really are revelations of God, then there's a way that we can really determine this thing and its true value and see it better than most other methodologies in the past, particularly the ones that relied heavily on just faith. So there's a lot more to cover in this subject, and we will when we come back, and we'll be back in about 2.5 minutes, give or take, from right now.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. MacFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm Niles McFlower. And tonight, we're talking about the virtues, revelations of God. And I think that we're kind of on a roll, so we can keep rolling, about the question of what is a virtue and how does it reveal God through a more structured or scientific way of examining it, and doing it in a way that is quantitatively possible to calculate. So, looking at it from the vantage point, going back to question of cooperation and sharing, I haven't covered sharing yet. So let's talk about sharing. You say, well, wait a second. Isn't cooperation sharing? Cooperation is what I said. It's basically the sharing of sense with others. So you can talk about it from that standpoint. But it isn't what I mean exactly when I say cooperation and sharing. Because once you cooperate, yes, your sense is becoming shared with others, and you're helping others to know what your sense is in comparison to everybody else's. And the hope is that people will find the most whole, or we'll call it the most virtuous sense that someone can have by increasing the level of intelligence in each activity or interaction between each other and others. But sharing is a little bit different, as I'm going to define it now. Because I think sharing goes beyond just sharing sense. I think sharing has to do with sharing the results of sense. Now, this gets really complicated. Because, no, I'm not talking about social justice. You know, like everybody's got to have the same stuff or else, you know, hey, it ain't just. No, that's evil. What this is a sharing of the product, so to speak, of the best parts of intelligent exchanges. When you share the best parts of what it means to interact together, other people are then capable of working backwards to the virtue of cooperation. And it leads them to recognize that the sharing of sense and the improvement of their own is a kind of, we'll call it, activity of intelligence in of itself. So sharing is not like making sure everybody's got the same stuff or the same anything. Sharing is giving people what they need so that they themselves can become more virtuous. Did you follow that? Let me say it again. Okay. Sharing could be, if you want to get completely messed up and wrong, could be just everybody gets the same stuff. I want the same stuff. I want to have the same opportunities, the same everything. That's social justice. That leads you into darkness and slavery. But if you help people to reach the same level of virtue, which is cooperation in a sense and sharing of sense, and also making sure that others can participate in this gaining of virtue, then you are at what is known as a soul level of sharing, not social justice level, but a level of soul. And the results are that it's relative and specific to each person on an individual basis, and it cannot be defined as making everybody into some kind of unit of automatons that will respond to the way some small group of people decide everybody should be. Okay. That's absolutely not what I'm talking about. It's actually the antithesis of it. All right, so how does this all fit together then? Where does God get revealed in this process? Well, especially when you add the part I just explained about sharing with the part about cooperation, you come up with a model that suddenly does do exactly what I'm saying. It does show to the people who are participating in it, and maybe to some very, we'll say, aware observers, that there is a mind and a thought that produces this effect, and that thought is spirit. Now, how come that's true? Well, because you get back to the same thing we talked about, the astral world, where it's much more obvious, by the way. It takes a lot more time and a lot more, we'll call it, intelligent interactions or changes towards more intelligent interaction in the physical world to reveal this thing that I'm going to tell you about. And the revelation is that there is behind all of the intelligent activity a single kind of thought that is in itself, we'll call it spirit, and it has a common thread. No matter where you go, how you use it, it comes out in the interactions. So what we call intelligent interactions, where time and space are being joined together, and it takes less time to do things, and there's less forces, after you get through all of that surface fact, you start recognizing that energy is following the thought of those folks who are doing this model, so that the karma goes down, the efficiency goes way up, and the system itself responds this way. Now, some people come to this conclusion through faith, and they actually see the effects of it, but they don't understand the science. That's okay, and if that's their level of ability to do so, that's fine. But if you're more able than that to do it, faith may not work for you in that realm. But what I'm talking about now is that what reveals itself is the spirit or thought of God in everything. As we intelligently interact better with each other, God comes out in the actual results of the interaction. And we can see evil much better, by the way. At the same time, we can become more aware of evil because evil's trying to do the opposite. And it suddenly, the whole thing becomes a giant revelation. Spirit is the answer, and spirit and soul could be almost stated to be synonymous in this example. So we could say that the sharing component, which is the soul component, brings about the almost synthesis of the entire system in the physical world now I'm talking about, producing a revelation of God through the really difficult, in this world, in the physical world, awareness of spirit itself. Now there's something else that comes into play here. You could say, well, now wait a second, I think you're still doing a poetry jump on us or something. No, no, no. What I'm talking about is true for human beings and human beings apart from the lower kingdoms, from human. Because humans have two senses that we didn't really fully cover yet, and that I have in many other shows. Those are the senses of spirit itself. they only work when the lower senses join together for the most part. Like, how much is that? It depends upon their ability to get it. So it varies. It could be 10%, 25%, 50%, 100%. But wherever your ability is at, it has to kind of match that. And when it comes together, where you can unify your senses to that particular level, the unity of the five lower senses, then the two higher senses of spirit operate. And when they operate, they are the synthesizers of the spirit part. They directly sense the spirit and can measure it. But they don't work until the lower senses, the senses of form, energy senses, are operating at or near our ability to be aware. Okay, that's the secret. That's how the system works. And is that measurable? Absolutely measurable. Because you could measure how much someone says, I have an understanding of God at this level. And you just ask them. I mean, there are a number of ways that you could test this as an example. But the most probably significant behavioral example would be, how much do forces play in your life? And how much have you reduced it through this methodology that I'm describing? And what can you conclude, therefore, about the existence or non-existence of God? And this could be a driving mechanism towards getting people to discover it on their own without having to be, you know, in some way convinced. I don't know how you convince anybody of this unless they experience for themselves, really. Now, why are some people so dogmatically against it, particularly if they're an atheist? Well, because they may have their individual senses working pretty good, but they aren't balanced and at a high enough level together in the physical body, as an example, to be able to get their spiritual senses working well enough so they don't have a sense of God. And so they're being very truthful. I don't sense God, so God doesn't exist. And if you say, well, there is a way to prove this, and you go through all the stuff I said, if they're open-minded enough, you might get someone. That's a big F, but it's worth a try. And that's what tonight's show is about. About saying this just for those who are listening, but for those who are listening and who know many other people who don't necessarily have this structure of thought. This is maybe a way to help others to deal with it. So pass the teaching on, so to speak. All right. So we have the apparatus to follow through with this and to reveal God to ourselves using the most difficult of examples, the physical world, where it's very difficult to prove what I'm saying, but you can do it. Remember, the balancing of sense is just as important as having one or two senses that work great and the other ones aren't, because that doesn't really help. You can have one or two or three out of the five senses in the physical body working at just a brilliant level, but the other two are just way out of whack, not working well. That could be a real handicap. If none of them are working up to your overall capability, that won't work either. You have to be at the point where your senses are developed enough to that point. Now, can you achieve but keep going beyond that? Yes, you can. But as you do, that's your new capability. And so you always have to match that, and you have to balance the senses, and then those spiritual senses snap into play, and suddenly you say, wow, I got it. I can sense the spirit in this intelligent activity. And as it became more intelligent, I can sense the spirit greater, especially as I bring and share it with others. If you don't share it with others, by the way, you also short-circuit the ability to use the spiritual senses together. You can use one or the other, but you won't be able to use both of them at the same time. So the passive forward part of it, the soul-giving part, is necessary to unify the two senses together so they can get unified with the other part. And if you don't do that, you say, well, I'm just going to be an armchair spiritual person. I'm not going to do anything with anybody else. But that's just not going to work because of the things that I'm explaining to you. And all this is based upon how energy, especially prana and chi, are moving through our bodies and a lot of other factors. But that really it still plays on energy following thought greater than its own. It's amazing. You can't have a revelation if the energy that's going through you is in following the thought of God, which means you have to be a co-participant in creating the virtue that you are revealing to yourself and maybe, hopefully, to others. You don't co-create. You don't directly experience at the level necessary to achieve all of this interconnectivity and the balancing and the whole thing. Okay, that's a mouthful. And you say, well, you went so fast. I don't know where I'm going to. But guess what? You can re-listen to the show in a few days, right? And you can hear it and say, well, what did he say here? Now maybe I could try that. Because, yeah, I'm not repeating myself over and over because I know that you can do that. All right, so let's continue on. So we just covered really one dimension, a little bit of the astral. What happens when we move to the astral? When that's the cooperation and sharing is the most difficult to achieve. The results are the poorest in general for most people. And life is the shortest. The senses are damaged relative in time the most quickly. People age the fastest. Not a great place. And as you lose sense, you lose consciousness, and as you lose consciousness, you suffer. So suffering is a big part of the equation, too, if you live in the physical world, obviously. But nonetheless, you don't have to experience it that way. You can change it. Most people don't. Most people wait till they go on to the astral world, where they suddenly, they say, I'm not dead. Oh, I thought I might be dead. I thought it was possible. I always wanted to believe I wasn't going to be dead, but I didn't know for sure. And I'm not dead. Well, this physical body, I don't have that anymore, but you know, it was all worn out anyway. I screwed that up pretty bad. And besides which, or if it was harmed in an accident or something sudden, you know, like that, it wouldn't be much use either. So it was not any longer useful. But now I got a new astral body, and it's in pretty good shape, and I can sense better. There's less forces. Why less forces? Because energy follows thought so much better. A thing called the quantum constant grows immensely. They just discovered it a couple months ago. I know I've been teaching it for decades, but they just discovered it a couple months ago, and I predicted that too. Well, go give me a prize, I know. So the thing is that the quantum constant is the one way to define it, although a lot of physicists don't even know this, is to what level does energy follow thought greater than its own? It sounds strange, but in quantum physics, energy does follow thought. That's been proven time and time again. As a matter of fact, the thought of quote-unquote the observer, including the senses of the observer, vastly changes the system of how energy suddenly jumps from one state to another and how it moves through time and space and how it interacts with each other and how it sometimes can be in more than one place at the same time. All of that changes by the thought of us or other things. All of it changes. There's proof abundant, hundreds of thousands of experiments, maybe millions, and with never any change to the result other than they recently discovered that the quantum constant is not constant. It changes based upon some elements of what we would consider to be dimensionality if dimensionality actually changes itself. And based upon the fact that some physicists believe there are other dimensions of time and space, that there is a superstring theory and some other stuff, even some supersymmetrists believe this, that ultimately that must mean that the quantum constant is different, vastly different, in other realms. I discovered this more from practical experimentation, but it doesn't matter. I had the knowledge, and I went in and used the knowledge to experiment and improve to myself what was happening. So this quantum constant changes. That means things are more and more indefinite. Now you might say, well, wait a second. When energy follows thought better, things become less definite? Yep, that's exactly what it means. I know that sounds hard to understand, but if the energy's own thought, which is more gravitational, is not controlling the foundation of existence, then the thoughtful things around the energy are affecting the energy so much that there's a great indefiniteness to whatever exists in what we call form. And that's exactly what happens when you get to the astral world. That's why cooperation and sharing are just not so much important. Whereas the direction of the energy, which is now a new dimensional element to time and space, becomes the critical part of, we'll call, the fundamentals of sense. We perceive sense, we perceive force, or we perceive intelligent activity. Those are two opposites. In the astral world, by whether the energy is moving away from us and towards others in some helpful fashion, or it's moving towards us and we disregard how much it may be helping others, or some combination of the two. But that's how we perceive energy there. It's very different than our perception of energy here. We still have some astral sense while we're physically alive, but we mostly ignore it. Sometimes we don't, especially when we're around people that we have a particular caring about, whether or not we are loving them or not, or they are to us or not. Then it makes a difference. But for the rest of the world, we may ignore it completely, be very selfish. In the astral world, it's prominent. It's much more prominent because we can directly sense whether someone's loving us or not loving us, being selfish, and the same for us in reverse, or to whatever levels of combination of those that people have or we have. And then we also have the issue of the indefiniteness of form. We can make out of the astral energy surrounding us virtually any form that is familiar to us in our imagination. And it could come from our imagination while we are physically alive, or newly formed imaginative thoughts while we're in the astral world. And the energy takes the shape and becomes the thing or things that we imagine. Now, you could imagine people, and they become the way you imagine them. The problem with imagining people or any animated object is the problem is in any story of this nature, and that is that if it is our thought that is controlling it, it becomes nothing more than a bunch of puppets. Even though they may look and act in some way like they're alive, we know the difference. And so it isn't very fulfilling to have relationships with robots. Now, we created it, and they look and smell and taste and feel like people, but they aren't, because underneath it, there's a lack of self. They don't have a self. They're just an extension of ourself, and that makes the relationship both boring and somewhat meaningless, and there's no real intelligent activity coming because we're not interacting. We are just simply pulling the strings. A lesson. Now, some people get into this solipsist position, and they don't mind it for a number of decades or so while living in the astral world, but before long, it does get old. And so they lose the interest in forming that kind of existence. Somewhat true in the opposite, where you're dealing with inanimate objects. You could create those as you desire, that's true, and they can be whatever you want them to be. But one of the problems is they won't stay together as long as they would in the physical world. Even if they do stay together pretty long, anyone that comes around and senses it could immediately change it by their own imagination and desires. Ah, that kind of could mess stuff up. Now, people are more concerned about not doing that when you move up in higher consciousness realms in the astral world. But in the lower world, it's done all the time. And trying to hold on to anything that is of any particular form is almost impossible, because people will mess with it. Or you can protect those things by using a lot of what we call your sense of protection, constantly reimagining the thing and keeping almost a field of protection around it so that it uses up somebody else's imagination and senses to even mess with it, but it does so with you as well. So it uses up everybody's senses more when the realm is like that, and that's the way it is, particularly in the 6 and 7 subworlds. The 5th, they've invented a society in which it's limited in various ways. But it's still part of life that things are created by people's imagination. And sometimes one of the ways they deal with it is by making people only imagine certain things and not others. So everybody lives in the same kind of house, in the same ways, which constantly is dealing with a restriction in creativity. And the people who don't like that can live afar from it, but then they have other problems because they have to be careful that no one comes and messes with their stuff because each one is a creative difference and it's not so easy in life. That's the fifth sub-role. Not so like that in any other place, but it's still like that there. All right, so as we look at love as being the equative factor and or selfish desire, those are the two opposites of this system, how does God reveal itself? Well, love is the giving of what others need. And if you give in intelligent ways, you know, gaining more intelligence in the interaction you have with others, then you give in ways to make them better givers themselves to others. And better means, in this case, some wisdom is involved and some more mental aspects besides just the creative imagination. When that's added in, the imagination becomes separate from and not any longer used as the primary means of thought. It is a tool, and you can use it at will, but it's not the way you just think. You think mentally, and then your desires don't control you, but your mental thought says what's best, and your creations come from an imagination that efficiently creates things that can last a considerable length of time. This is particularly true from the fourth subworld and up. It works quite well in those dimensions, and a lot of people tell me, well, I want to go there. Well, you can. But your consciousness has to be great enough so you're not so selfish that you screw up that world and yourself at the same time. And if you do, you'll fall asleep, won't be able to remain conscious at all. When you lose consciousness, you fall asleep, and you go to a subworld where you can awaken and be operative. This is the system, and it works on sense. If your senses can't work effectively in a realm of the astral world, you go to a lower one. Until you don't have enough sense to just keep your astral body living. And then it dies, just the way the physical did, so to speak, but over a much longer period of time, with some differences in the way it dies. So in some ways, slower, and in other ways, we'll say, more dramatic if you were to observe it over time, because it accelerates differently. In the physical world, people do age, but they don't age like in a few months very often to a tremendous amount. Maybe at the very end of life. You know. Whereas in the astral world, you can see people changing back and forth sometimes based upon how they're living, either through desire and selfishness or love. There could be more dramatic changes in both directions than we're used to seeing in the physical world. It's hard for us to recognize that people could go back to a more youthful, better sensing body, but you can actually see that better in the astral world than in the physical. All right, so energy follows thought greater than its own. The thought is greater to some extent, and the energy is affected by the quantum constant to a much greater extent, so it follows way better than the thought. All things being equal in the astral world than it does in the etheric physical world, the real. Also, this is far from a sacred planet. And so the lack of sacredness, the lack of spiritual thought being present in most interactions between people and between people and things causes us to be much more in illusion in all the realms that human beings exist in. We just are kind of lacking good sense because our spiritual senses are used too infrequently and not in great balance, and the results are not good. We aren't sacred. Sacred means that we can most of the time, majority of the time, sense our Creator. And because the reason we therefore can do that is based upon everything I've said so far about senses, but also the planet itself improves. The whole surroundings are better. And that's a sacred world. But we're not there. And will we get there soon? I don't think so. But here's the point. We came here because that was the reason. I mean, a major part of the reason souls are here is because they were either bored or they thought it wasn't enough of a challenge for what they were able to do to stay in a world that was in better shape than this. This is the place we chose to come because this is the place where things suck. Great. And don't blame me for this, because when you go back to being your soul eventually through this whole process that I'm talking about, and the soul makes the decision dispassionately. And the soul is us. Eventually, our consciousness will rejoin in the soul state. And we'll just say, yeah, I know it sucked while I was down there and everything. Good. But I'm here for a different reason than to just have fun. I'm here to create a more virtuous planet, one that eventually will be sacred, like the, maybe some other planet the soul's been on in the distant past. Yeah. Okay, so we're making that choice. Now, as we look at this question of love, and this is real important, I said that we're averaging 2% in this world. We took a lot of the countries and averaged them all together. But if you look at the astral world, there's a jump in consciousness. It's like a double. It's like 4%. Well, you might say, well, that doesn't sound too good. 4%, at least 96% of the time you're selfish. Actually, that's a lot. And it really does make a difference. That, along with the change in the quantum constant, allows people to be far more virtuous. And much more of God is revealed almost immediately upon arriving in the astral world. And people do believe that they are in a spiritual realm, and there's some argument that could be made that that's more true than not, and that they're closer to God. And that in their religious values, they may say, well, this is heaven-like. Maybe it's not exactly the way I thought heaven might be, but then again, who knew? Who knows? Got to be here to find out. And different subworlds have different experience issues, so you can't really say what heaven is like, because life is diverse, but it's homogeneous within subworld to some extent, and it's very different, very heterogeneous between subworlds. So a great deal of differences between the subworlds, but within each subworld, a good deal of similarity in the average level of consciousness. A bit different, considerably different than the physical world, where everybody's kind of crunched together and just all mishmash. You have the most conscious people sometimes living next door to the least conscious. I mean, it can happen, for sure. So this is an interesting point. Things change. Different. The experience of sense is different, and the revelation of God is different. A number of people go to the astral world and seek more revelation of God and seek higher consciousness by actually trying to live in higher subworlds that they do know about. And sometimes they're successful at that. They actually offer classes and do things like this to help people do it. That's love. Now you can say, well, why isn't it cooperation and sharing, just like in the physical world? Well, it's like the love has replaced it. It's not that cooperation and sharing doesn't exist there, but people do it more naturally through love than just comparing their senses and coming to some conclusion about it. They have a much greater feeling about love and a much greater sense of it in general. And so it's more efficient to do it by saying, oh, there's more love here. We're going in the right direction. Than trying to go with the more, we'll say, strident and difficult and analytical approach of trying to figure out how much you're cooperating based upon how much intelligent activity there is, etc. You can use that model in love, in the astral world. And there's some people actually do. Some of the people in the third subworld actually have that model more than not. But it's just in addition to also sensing love. It isn't like they give up the sense of love. They just add to it. And so it's a kind of different system than the other subworlds in that respect. Now, where does that leave us then? How much is God revealed then? If you're at 4% instead of 2% on a societal basis in the whole part, well, it's a big deal because many more people believe God exists from the fifth subworld up It's only in the sixth and seventh that you have the more doubting folks. And even in the sixth, there's more people who believe in God than not, by far. And in the seventh, people have a viewpoint of God as a more fixed with, we'll call it, their presumptions as they existed in the material world. They haven't given up as much of those things because they're still trying to live a quasi-material life, and they want things. And they think that God is smiling on them when they have all these recreations of things in their world, even though it uses up a lot of their sense and it's absurd. It doesn't. You don't need the things. You just need the interactions that the things may have. That you want that they want the things. It makes them feel good. And that's what they desire. Well, that desire costs them because they can't sense God in the much more improved way that the astral world gives them of love. They're so restricted in their love that people in the seventh subworld may not sense God really much more than they sensed when they were in the physical world. And that causes their astral bodies to get used up real quick, like a couple hundred years they would be gone. And it also causes a lot more suffering after a few decades of time because their senses can diminish rapidly with that kind of unusual selfish attitude in a world where their bodies can change rapidly if they aren't loving virtually at all. Then they could really reverse the whole idea that your bodies live longer and screw it up really bad. They can also become possessed and victimized by people and even monstrous animals and things. So it is not a good place to be in that kind of headspace, but some people do that, particularly the ones who live their physical life so attached to materiality and oftentimes ignore love in place of having things. That's a big deal. A horrible existence, to say the least. Have I seen this? Yes, unfortunately, I have, and it's not a pretty picture. It does have in it matching suffering that many people would claim to be karmically deserved, but still, when you go there, even if you're objective and everything else, it really pings your heart to see and feel the what people go through this self-inflicted destruction to themselves and to a way of life that leads into very dark areas. Sometimes they get possessed by evil because evil's right next door in the eighth sphere, and it has a presence in the seventh subworld. And it's not hard to get possessed. That can always lead to very disastrous results. And some of these folks try to possess people in the etheric world and sometimes the physical parts of the world as well here, and that always leads to a very bad life for them. They use up a lot of sense in doing that. Within a decade or two, they can become nearly senseless, and the results are disastrous for them the rest of their existence, 150 years maybe or 200 years of just terrible suffering in the astral world. Terrible. Yeah. So this is, and then some people see this. See, this is the good news, that while those folks are suffering, there's other folks in the seventh subworld that may be a little better off, and they notice this. And maybe they say, oh, this is bad. They start getting it. And that's how another way to God can be revealed, is through their being evil so destructively imposed upon people around you, that even if you were almost as selfish, you might say, wait, I don't want to go down that road. And it can be a wake-up call. And because it's so homogeneous, it's not obscured by people with great deals of differences among themselves. This can be, you can live in a whole city of folks like this. That's a pretty big wake-up call for a lot of people. It's not for everybody. I'm not saying it's going to get to everybody this way, but it certainly could be, and that's a good thing. So that's what I meant also earlier when I said that evil, the exposure of evil can be a revelation of God. All right, so let's move on. The other aspects of the astral world are really amazing in terms of the virtue of love, is that it's refined, and becomes more and more focused out and not personally involved with as you raise your consciousness in the astral supplements. And it can reach a point where you do reach an almost universal level, especially in the second and first astral subworlds, which are sometimes referred to as the spiritual subworlds, because you're living a spiritual life. The life itself is spiritual. Therefore, the virtues become extolled as the most important part of existence. And when that is really the motive for people's living, things change rapidly. Life expectancy goes way up. And the senses improve, become more refined. And the way that people love is so much more wise, with a lot more mental structure to the ways of giving. And the desires they have, sometimes referred to as fixed desires or glamours, are reduced almost daily. So that after a few decades of time, many people have very little common monastic connection, meaning their desires are controlling how they think. Their imagination is not the leading cause of how they think. And they don't and are compulsively driven to do things because they have a feeling that's inside of them that hasn't gone away and has constantly a compelling aspect to it. Once that's gone, that's a very big thing. And within a few decades of time in the second subworld, and sometimes less than that in the first, people are in great shape. Now, to get to the first, they have to have most of the glamours gone anyway. So you're not going to have a heck of a lot of them. But the number that you're going to have is low, and you're going to get over them in less than 5 or 10 years. So it's an amazing way of developing the self into the higher self, where a person is living as a living soul, but in the astral world. Now, most people don't make it to the second or first astral subworld, because to live this way usually requires that you did some of it while you were physically alive. It's just too hard to change that much about yourself while you're in the lower subworlds. Again, the more love you can exchange and the more intelligent activity you can interact with others about, the faster you change. But if you're in, say, the fourth subworld, which is not a bad place to be, but you may not make it to the second or first because it just takes too much time to get rid of these glamours that are so fixed in people and to not concern yourself with how you appear to others. The desire to appear spiritual is a serious addiction in all of the astral subworlds. It's common to all of them, and it's worse in the fourth. And if in the third, people want to not only look good spiritually, but they want to appear very, very mental, more so than they actually are, so they can convince other people that they are not only loving, but extremely wise. And they put on airs about their wisdom way past the levels that they are actually wise. That's a big problem in itself as well. And it curtails the ability to unify those spiritual senses with the other five of form in the astral body. The five of form are called empathy. The two spiritual senses are called super empathy. And when they're joined together, you have completed super empathy or completed spiritual empathy, which allows you to function without being belabored by the common monastic connection where your creative imagination and your desires control most of your life. And you block out too much of your mental reasoning. And you're not very wise, therefore. Not wise enough. Actually, some people in the astral are very loving. They're just not loving enough in relationship to their wisdom, or they're not, I shouldn't say they're not, I said that wrong, they're not wise enough in relationship to their loving to balance it, and therefore it throws them into a tailspin, and they don't actually get out of it. They get stuck. They may want to, in an intellectual fashion and in a desire, live in a more conscious realm, but they can't maintain their consciousness for more than a minute or two if they try to go to these higher astral realms. They just literally lose consciousness. Their senses fail, and they're back to wherever they came from. That's how And after a few trips, they have trouble even leaving for maybe a week or so because it just uses up too much of their sense. It's a fascinating idea that the virtues are revealed through God, but at the same time, you can hide them from yourself in the astral world by literally your desire to look better to other people and your desire to, well, do all the other things, including be loved more. Now, this is a difficult thing to understand. Why, if giving love is so important, why is receiving love a problem? Well, the receiving of love always has to be accompanied by equal levels of gratitude. And only the people who reach the spiritual realms achieve that. Even the people in the third subworld of the astral world, which is people there are pretty conscious, way more than 4% conscious, because I said that was the average for the whole dimensional part. I think it'd be 10% or 15% or 20% spiritually conscious. But the problem is that they still believe or think that others have an implied responsibility to be loving towards them, and they resent it when others aren't. And they can be quite resentful. I mean, to the point of, making people who aren't doing a good enough job loving not live where they are. I mean, it's a pretty crazy system if you think about it. But, okay, so their thought process about this is, I'll love you provided you love me. Well, it's a contradiction, you see. I don't know if you follow that, but you can't have the basis of love being loved. It doesn't work. Love is giving so that others themselves can be giving, but not necessarily back to you. And even if you wisely give to them, this is a big confusion in the third astral subworld, even if you wisely give to them at a profound level of wisdom, okay, if you still have the desire, secretly, that you want to get love back at some proportion, at least, of whatever you're giving, and even though you're giving it wisely, you will lose some of your sense and ability to wisely give, and your consciousness will not go past a certain level, usually about 50%. You can't get over 50% consciousness no matter what you do because you got this revolving thing that constantly is trapping you. You keep giving and giving, but then some people that you give to may be giving, but they're not giving back to you, so you'll get ticked off or whatever. And you think it's, well, I'm not getting my share of it. And you think it's right. It's even right. There's some arguments made in this fashion. It's right to not give to others who aren't giving to you. Okay? That's where the big problem comes. And you can be a whole group of people, so it doesn't have to be an individual. You can say, everybody over 375 years of life in this subworld doesn't give well enough to give to the person that they're giving to. And so you don't think they're grateful enough to you, so you're not going to give to them. So the problem is gratitude. If you judge your own giving by being grateful to the fact that someone is receiving love, even if it isn't benefiting you in any particular way, you see it as benefiting God. Because virtue is to grow God, it's not to grow your individual consciousness. Try to argue that logic, by the way, in the third subworld, and you're going to get a heck of a lot of arguments in the opposite way. More based upon logic than love. Logic would tell you that you shouldn't give to others who don't give back in similar fashion to you, because then obviously they're not getting the wisdom and they don't have the gratitude. Well, they might not have the gratitude to you, but if they give wisely to others, then giving to them is appropriate, even though you don't get something back. That's my argument, and I think that's the way the system shows people. It's a revolution. The people that follow that kind of crazy system usually they start climbing in sense, and then it falls back. They climb in sense and fall back, and then they climb in consciousness and fall back. And up and down pogo stick nature of their life tells them that things aren't right. They must be doing something wrong, and they do suffer every time they go back. Every time they suffer. So their life has a suffering element to it, but they have to figure out what's wrong in that element. And that's where part of the problem comes, is whether they're going to do that or not before they expire. All right. So there's one of the enigmas, we can say, about the astral world. There's a lot of strange things that go on there. But the biggest thing to understand about the virtue in the astral world is that there is still more of it. And even among the more selfish people, they tend to be less selfish. So there's an improvement in consciousness overall in relative terms. Now, some people, if they visited the lower subworlds, would say, ooh, this isn't great. Well, sure, they wouldn't want to live there. But if you compare to those same folks, if you could, who are living still, or were living, or had lived, or are still living in the physical world, you'd see that they actually became less selfish, not more, when they went on to live in the astral world. The forces are less overall. That makes it better. It's by design a more spiritual place. And that reveals a lot about God. Let me explain. You see, this journey we're in gives us freedom to create more virtue with our Creator, God. But that doesn't mean that God didn't create virtue and others following God did create virtue long before we arrived, right? So there is a world of virtue around us, and that virtue is revealed to us as our consciousness increases and we participate a little bit more intelligently in our interactions with others. As we use these interactions to grow other people's consciousness, our own consciousness grows and we start getting the big picture. We also realize that this is not only growing all of humanity, it's growing God itself, and now the real reason for life's existence comes through. Life is here to grow more, not only of itself, but more of its Creator. And its Creator was so brilliant, it realized that this is the only way, that the only way it came up with anyway, that life can be self-created and at the same time have the opportunity to co-create with its Creator, which allows the Creator to experience the growth of all of its life. God is not a static being. God is a growing being through those things that it creates, which is all of life. And life can co-create with God and experience all of God eventually, but it has to get beyond the human kingdom to achieve anywhere near that kind of experience or that kind of consciousness. Eventually it does, though, through the same principles that I'm talking about, the virtues. But these are higher virtues. I don't know how far we're going to get to tonight, but these are higher virtues, some of them beyond the human kingdom, but they still allow life to eventually co-create and eventually in a very close to equal way with its Creator, making us quasi-godlike. I mean, we're not really even that close, but it's way beyond human. So if you talk about omniscience, omnipotence, omnipresence, that is a huge improvement over what we're humans are. Those three things are just big, big levels of increases in consciousness beyond a human being, right? So this is big. This is good. All right. We'll leave the astral world because we don't have a lot of time to cover all of the ins and outs and nuances of all these different elements of how virtues reveal God, but it's we're getting closer. And hopefully this is scientific enough for the people who have their doubts to be able to start thinking about and make experiments in their own life. Even while they're physically alive, you can test out love here. You don't have to wait to go to the astral world. All right, let's talk about truth in the monastic realm, because these are the realms that humans directly experience, because they have mental senses too. Those are really obscure. Most people don't know what they even are. We have some feelings that tell us we have some degree of astral sense, but the mental sense is really hard because we think that our thoughts are all our own, somehow magically created, but most of our thoughts come from the thoughts of others. We do create some thoughts ourselves, but most of it comes from others. And we ignore that sometimes. All right, so in order to have thoughts from others register with us, we have to have senses, and we use them. We have five senses of form, two senses of spirit in the lower mental world that tells us through examples of concepts whether or not something is whatever it is in terms of a thought form or a form of thought, and it tells us a lot about the energy factors involved in that and whether or not it is intelligently represented in interaction with others. Intelligent interaction in thought is thought that is open-minded, that is humble, and still has a different kind of gratitude than love. Well, love certainly can be part of, you can give thought to people. Teachers do that, and I'm trying to do that right now. But the point is, it goes beyond that, because thought is not just the gratitude of giving, it's the gratitude of creating wholeness. Others trying to help someone else have more wholeness in thought, and that's truth. And so the wholeness in the thought allows a concept, this is what wholeness means, definition, a concept which is like a structure or formula of thought fits all of the examples presently in the person's own mind. When a concept fits all the examples a person has, that's whole thought. And when it fits all the examples that everybody else has, then you are giving whole thought together. And that's what is so wonderful about, and what people should be grateful for, when that occurs here in the physical world. Now, I'm going to tell you, this is the hardest time for that to happen in all of human history, right now. Now, why in the heck would that be the case? There's been, there's history, there's prehistory. Humans have been around a lot longer than we know, most people know about. And yet, I'm saying right now, it's the hardest time. Why? Because of the nature of the structure of the race that we're in. We're in the most mental race so far developed, the fifth race. That fifth race has a sub-race, and we're almost everybody on the planet in the fifth sub-race. The fifth of the fifth has a problem in doing just what we just talked about, in sharing truth with others, and in helping others to find truth. You can find truth within yourself if you're a good thinker and somewhat open-minded for yourself, but helping others to find truth, which is in some ways teaching, but it isn't only that, is a big, big problem, because you've got to have consensus of open-mindedness, not just about the person who's doing the teaching or the person doing the sharing or giving or whatever you want to call it. It has to also come from those who are being given to. When people have the proclivity that people have right today to want to be able to find truth, they sometimes reject the truth of others and are threatened by it because they believe they're more important to themselves and to other people when they find a truth that others haven't found. And they're more interested in being recognized for having what looks like a quasi-truth, because the truth really is avoiding a person who doesn't want to share and give it to others and help others to gain some truth themselves and be grateful to the others that get more truth from it. You see, the gratitude is so important here, because what happens in most cases is that some people say, well, I'll give you some truth, I'll tell you all this stuff. But they're not grateful to others who find more truth in themselves, particularly if it isn't 100% the way the other person thought it was. They become ungrateful. Quite the opposite. They become defensive, argumentative, closed-minded, lack humility. Humility means that they aren't willing to see or admit that they make mistakes in their thinking. So it's an amazing, amazing scenario that we're talking about here. That as a race, a whole human race on this planet, we right now are just having huge amounts of problems with egotism, closed-mindedness, no humility, and no gratitude, even if we bother to teach anybody. And the gratitude comes from the person who's teaching or helping others to find truth to those who are finding it, if at any level, even if it's that close to being the same, there has to be gratitude. Just listening. I'm grateful for all of you who are listening out there and all of those that you talk to about, because even if you disagree with me, this exchange is helping both of us, and I'm grateful to that. That's open-mindedness. That's humility. It means that, well, some of the things I may be saying are wrong. There's no question of that. So I'm grateful that other people are listening so I can find out where I'm wrong. Right? Well, not so much with most people, unfortunately. We live in a world of self-protection when it comes to thought. That causes the senses to immediately, the mental senses, to become damaged, particularly in the lower mental body, but also the higher mental senses as well over time. And the mind diminishes. And as we see, as people age, they become less able to create with their minds because their minds have become diminished in their ability to sense. Without the ability to mentally sense, creation mentally fails. People become non-creative. They can virtually, and this can start happening soon after the age of 28 to 35. It's scary. By the time people are 50, 60 years old, they may be done. No creation at all. And if you look and you see who have been the most creative people, it's always people that are younger. Why is that? Well, not always, but a lot of the time. It's because of the egotism and arrogance. Now, arrogance is a little different than egotism. Remember I talked about the astral body and how it could become very ungrateful in its love? Well, arrogance is where you're both egotistical and you're ungrateful in your astral way of loving. And then you got both. Well, people don't even deserve anything I'm going to give. I'm not even going to bother to teach them anymore because it's not even worth it. That's arrogant. I'm just so far beyond them, they're never going to figure this out, so what the heck? Why bother? Arrogant people have no humility, for all intents and purposes, no gratitude. And they lose their minds very quickly. They may have some period in their early life they could actually create something, but they could be gone in their 30s for sure, in terms of creation of anything of significance. Arrogance is toxic to the mental body. Wow. So if you're creating the virtues that I'm talking about in the mental body, oftentimes it frees you also from problems in the astral body. You can break the kama-manasa connection in part that way. The other thing is that the amount of joy that comes from open-mindedness is actually considerably greater than the amount of joy that comes from what's called giving, loving in wise ways astrally alone. Why is that? Well, astral loving many times does not result in the long-term significant advancement, we'll say, of consciousness overall in the person. Whereas if you enlighten their mind, many times they'll struggle, but they can get more astral going later, and there is a double whammy effect. You get more for the same amount of time and energy, and it's much more efficient. And joy is the recognition that what you gave to others in your trying to be virtuous, and you are able to recognize that the others are being more virtuous, somewhat as a result of what you've done. That's joy. That's where joy comes from. When you have that pretty consistently in a large enough level, it actually reaches a point called bliss. It's just more or less a bigger, more consistent level of joy. And the mental virtues lead to that more often than the astral does. So people, when they say in the astral world, well, I feel so joyful, you know, it's usually not what they're really, they're feeling some level, maybe a slight level of joy, but, and they may exaggerate it, but it's not the profound levels of joy and bliss that can be gained from creating mental virtues. And revelation, I'll talk about the revelation of God in a monastic or mental sense. this is a kind of big picture. It's much different from the astral world, which has its moments, and they're certainly important. But the bigger picture of God comes through much stronger. What is the big picture? Well, that God is a co-creating being who created life so that life could go on to create itself and then eventually, as a human being and beyond, co-create with its creator and do so on a conscious level. This comes through much stronger to those who are creating virtues in the monastic realm, particularly the higher monastic realm. They get a huge dose of this every time they do it, and it tremendously changes, improves their own consciousness, while it is a great deal more joyful because others are so much more efficiently affected by it. This is the big deal. Unfortunately, most people don't really pay a lot of attention to creating mental virtue until they reach the mental world after they die from the astral. Now, that doesn't mean people in the astral world don't do it. The people in the second and first astral subworlds almost do it all the time, but that's a small percentage of the people who live in the astral world. The rest of the form astral subworlds, you don't find it very much. And that's the problem, because those people are not really seeing the big picture of God. Now, people in the higher astral subworld, especially the spiritual ones, are starting to teach angels wisdom more and more to people in the lower. And actually, it's having its effect. Its effect is to help raise the consciousness of people in these lower subworlds, help them to see God in the bigger picture sense. And when I say angel's wisdom, I'm not talking about necessarily my brand of it, but it is something pretty close. And it has most of the components of the concepts of ideas that I have for long periods of time talked about and taught here. It's getting close to 10 years now. It will be beginning of September or end of August to 10 years. And so that in itself is what they're doing to make a difference, and it's starting to make some headway. It's not slow, but it's not as slow as it used to be. That's good, because when someone's in the astral world, if they start becoming more mentally attuned, they get rid of more glamours more quickly, and they aren't going to be reborn in a next or a future lifetime with those glamours intact, and they'll be gone. Those glamours are a big trouble for another incarnation sometime in the future, and they have to be dealt with sometime. So it's a good thing. Plus, they help the whole world. The whole world has a revelation as each person adds to it. It is an additive thing on an individual level. How can you get together and have like kumbayas of thousands or millions of people and somehow change the astral world? It has not been successful in that way. God created us as individuals, not as a collective, like the bees or ants. There's a reason for that. That is, the most amount of freedom comes from individualization of consciousness, and the most amount of creativity follows from that. You get less creation. You may get better love. I'm not kidding. You may get, in some circumstances, better love, but at a tremendous cost of creation and freedom. It's not worth it, and it leads to enslavement if you go too far down that road. So don't think that, why don't we all just become super loving and not worry about being creative? Well, that's not God. It's not spirit. Spirit is an equal, balanced level between those two. And if you choose to go down only one side of the track, eventually you fall into darkness. You know, it's difficult to believe that, but it's true. Now, for a specific lifetime, there have been some people that have been proponents of just that one kind of existence, sometimes referred to them as saints. Those people, it's okay for them to do it. We need occasionally one individual to stand out in a certain way, maybe it's through super loving abilities that are very wise, to just give us a keynote, something that is, in their own expression, it's creative because they are more like that than anybody else in a certain way that's very loving. Just as some people have been super creative, but not as much loving. Well, that's not balanced either. But there's, you know, it's another keynote. And it doesn't necessarily have to fall to darkness. But that's just one life, and it's one part of one life we live, whether physically alive. They usually correct it or balance it more when they get to the astral and mental world. But, you know, and that's why there's such uniqueness to this individual model, because you can have all these different ways of living that can add together and give us this tremendous variety, which is terrific. But a world without variety, it's a world that's enslavement and evil. And that's something that is hard for humans to gain an understanding of until the planet itself is near or at a sacred level. So we are constantly challenged with this, particularly while we're physically alive. And many people are duped into believing that, nah, you don't want to have a balance. You want to go this way or that way. Okay. So the monastic realm leads us closer to truth, more wholeness in our perspective. But again, we're missing another body of sense. The astral senses are gone, except the ones that were enlightened. And even those can't be used much. So we have even less of a human body of sorts, a total, and human senses. They're gone. Now, the spiritual senses do remain. I didn't explain that, but I should. Only the senses of form diminish. The spiritual senses are completely additive. As much as you use them, you keep them from one plane to the next. Now you can say, but how does that make any sense? If you can keep just the spiritual senses from the physical world, how does that help you in the astral world? Well, it helps you because you can sense what's wrong with the physical world and make adjustments in the astral world to compensate and to help maybe the next incarnations of everybody around you. You can do a lot of things that are helpful. You can't come back to this world and change anything. Not really. But you can make a whole bunch of differences that work in the astral world and on. So it does pay to have those joined together. In the mental world, people, when they join what's enlightened of their astral senses, it may give them a little bit of an up, a little more, we'll say, help, because they're dealing with the remainder of what is known as the Akashic part of their life, the past. They deal with their past, because the past is the whole thing, actually, in the mental world. It's a whole part of time. And you can go in and relive certain parts of the present lifetime and maybe some prior ones that were similar to where you were selfish and ways of interacting. Now, this is like virtual reality thing. When you change it, it makes it easier for everybody to think in a more truthful way that lives in the mental world, and even for some people using their mental senses in the astral and physical world, there's some improvement. But you're mostly doing it to help your soul not be belabored with such egotism and selfishness that you exhibited while you were physically and astrally alone. And this goes through not just that lifetime, but through anything that is a similar nature from prior lifetimes that hadn't been dealt with. You can go back 100 years before. And we live that time. And most people don't know this, but it's true. You can actually live through history over again. It's not 100% accurate because it's composed of the thoughts and memories of people that wasn't 100% accurate. But it's close enough to relive. And so you can live in the past. And some people find that fascinating. It's sort of like time travel. But the difference is, and this is very important to recognize in terms of time travel, this kind of time travel, you can't change the past in terms of the past incidences or interactions people had. You can change the past in terms of what people think today from the past. That can be changed. I don't know if you followed that, so let me go over it one more time. That's a complicated thing to think through, isn't it? Or think about it this way. Let's use an example. Let's say I'm in my own mental Akasha, although I could be helping someone in Akasha, but I won't give that example. I'll say my own. And let's say when I was 15 years old. Let's say when I was 5 years old. When I was 5 years old, I wasn't particularly grateful to a couple of semi-distant relatives who tried to be nice to me. And then I repeated this similar kind of behavior when I was 15, maybe with different relatives or even the same ones. And then I did it with some friends who acted more like relatives when I was 25 or 30. And those incidences all came from the fact that I was ungrateful for someone telling me things that were mentally true or more true than my thought was, and I ignored it. I was egotistical about it. That's what I'm dealing with when I say people were giving to me in a mental way. Remember, not an actual. And I would renounce it, reject it, think they were crazy or whatever, or just ignore it. And then I go into the mental, and because of that, I had an effect on a lot of other people now. All throughout my life, this selfishness, this egotism I had a way I might have treated if I had children, which I didn't, but if I had children, I treated all kinds of other younger people and all kinds of other people who might be relatives or have some kind of familiar attitude or relationship to me. All of this is coming together in a certain way. And by changing that my own path, I make it easier for everybody with that kind of egotism to think a little easier in the mental world, whether they're physically alive, astral alive, or mentally alive. I just make it easier. My own egotism screws up everybody else's. That's something to understand. That's why I'm grateful to people when they listen to this show. Do you see? The truth helps everybody. My untruth, my egotism, hurts everybody. By correcting it for my own past and in the present, now when I come out of this experience of my past, I'm now changed in the present. But I've also changed the experience from the past from being an albatross both around my neck and everybody else's that thinks in a similar way. Whew, a lot of words. Okay, so that's what I mean. And actually, this is a fascinating part of the particularly the lower monastic world, is that you get to relive whole parts of your life. They're connected together by the same kinds of egotism, not by the same incidents. It could be different to people under different circumstances, but the same kind of egotistical, closed-minded thinking. People can spend hundreds of years of time doing this, depending upon how much time they tried to undo it in earlier parts of their life. It's best not to have to do it because once you correct it and come out of the thing, everybody can think better, well, that's good. But for how many years of time have you belabored people in their thought because you had that egotism? So you see, better to deal with it while you're physically alive, not only for yourself, but for everybody else, because it's easier to think more truthfully. Our thoughts have an effect on everybody. It's hard to understand that thought is really the exchange in the universe. Energy follows thought greater than its own. Thought is the creator of existence and reality, of self, and thought is spirit, or God's existing presence in all things. Because all things have some connection to spirit that exists from the third or spiritual plane down. Wow. They all have spirit in them. Now, above that, spirit is no longer separated from beingness. So monads, you could say they have spirit, but their beingness is spirit. They are spirit. They don't think separate from their existence. In the planes from the third or spiritual plane down, spirit becomes separated from energy. And so there's a disconnection between interaction and spirit. That isn't true in the higher realm. But for our purposes, it's good enough to understand virtue. That's a big deal, okay? And I think that it's really probably behooves all of us to take some appreciation of the things that I'm mentioning to think about them. Because most human beings do not experience the mental world and their mental senses very well. And the things I'm talking about right now, a lot of people are shrugging their shoulders and saying, I don't know what you're talking about. Because you don't have a sense of it very well, and you got to really ponder on it And you got to maybe read some stuff or listen to other shows that I've done, because this is not enough, maybe, information about this very difficult area of sense. But once you do study it, you got a good chance of being able to become more aware of your own mental senses. Once you are aware of your mental senses, then you go, the guy was telling the truth. I thought he was smoking something. Hey. Then it's probably also true that my thoughts, when I'm egotistic, will disturb other people. And when I think in truth, it helps others to think in truth. Well, because of a big deal, right? All right. So, virtue in the metal world is much closer to God, and therefore it's closer to seeing how we're all connected. How we're all individuals, and at the same time, how we're all connected. It's just amazing, isn't it? All at the same time, too. All right. So, boy, we're moving along here quite too quickly, I guess. Let me move to the next realm. Now, you might say, well, I thought that the three realms of human is the mental, the astral, and the physical. Yes, but the next realm has a very strong impact on human beings, even though humans don't have a huge amount of Buddhic sense. We still have a sense in Buddhi in the spiritual senses. It's our five lower senses of Buddhi that we just not good at. Okay? But our spiritual senses are always there. And they can sense God through beauty. Beauty is the virtue, not truth.